This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
With so much easy money that's been created by central banks, are they now causing more problems than perhaps they are solving? Welcome back to the second hour of the Financial Sense News Hour and the Big Picture. And to answer that question is Chris Sheridan with his guest, William White, in an interview that was done in September of this year. Chris.
Joining us on the show today is William White. He is the chairman of the Economic and Development Review Committee at the OECD, also the former chief economist at the Bank for International Settlements, and he speaks with us today to provide his personal views on the global situation we currently face. Bill, you've just been awarded the Distinguished Adam Smith Prize by the National Association of Business Economists. I want to say congratulations for that.
Thank you.
But what's interesting is that this award has also been given to Ben Bernanke, current Fed Chair Janet Yellen, and a long list of other highly influential economists that have really stressed the importance of monetary policy in shaping the economy for good. However, your prize lecture, which was just given weeks ago, it seems to offer a bit of a different view, and one where monetary policy has been guided what you refer to as flawed theory. Do you mind telling our audience a little bit about the message that you just gave only weeks ago?
I should note just in beginning that, yeah, there have been people like Ben Bernanke and Janet Yellen and even Paul Krugman who got this prize in the past. But as I ran down the list, there's quite a number of mavericks that have won this thing in the past, too. George Soros got it just a few years ago. Henry Kaufman a while back. You remember him? Dr. Doom. Ken Rogoff, who's sort of somewhere in the middle. So they seem to have a sort of a fairly eclectic view of who's made a contribution and who hasn't, but who has made a special contribution. The basic message of my lecture, I think, is that we've been into the central bank easing since about 2007, 2008. And my sense of it is that the early stuff that was done by the central banks was absolutely spot on. I mean, it was designed to restore financial stability, particularly after the Lehman's crisis. And the central banks did all sorts of stuff, and I think it was totally correct what they did. But then around sort of 2009, and particularly with sort of QE in the States, remember in 2010, Ben Bernanke made a number of speeches. What became obvious was that the purpose of the exercise of this ultra-easy monetary policy was no longer sort of restoring financial order. It was a quite different thing. It was using monetary policy to stimulate aggregate demand, okay, to get the economy going again. And my paper basically says two things. One, it's not going to work. Even in the U.S., and I think we've seen this, even in the U.S., there's been a very subpar recovery. And elsewhere, it's often been significantly worse. Some countries nowhere near the level of output that they'd achieved before the crisis. So item number one, it should not have been expected to work, and it hasn't worked, okay, to stimulate aggregate demand. The second thing is that I feel, and I try to document this in the paper, that there's a large number of undesirable side effects arising from this totally unprecedented setting of monetary policy. And these side effects we've seen in the advanced market economies. We're seeing it increasingly in the emerging market economies. And I can go into the details of this later if you want, but the central point is that I see a kind of curve that basically says the efficiency of monetary policy goes down with time. And the harmful side effects of policy go up with time. And at some point, those two curves intersect, and the central banks are doing more harm than good. And my feeling is that this has been the case for quite some period of time. More recently, there seem to have been a growing number of people who seem to agree with me. So that's the basic message, more harm than good. And we must pass the baton to the governments, who are the only people that can resolve what is effectively a global solvency crisis. If it were a global illiquidity crisis, the central banks could do it, but it's not. It's a solvency crisis. So that's basically the main message of the paper. And lots of detail, of course, about the reasons why it won't work to stimulate aggregate demand. Not saying it won't work at all, but it won't work with the strength expected. And all sorts of detail about what those unexpected and undesirable side effects are. And I think they're very substantial, and they're far too little recognized by most people who are thinking about these problems.
I should say that if anyone in our audience wants to read this paper, it's titled Ultra Easy Money, Digging the Hole Deeper, and that's with a question mark, and that was your Adam Smith Prize lecture that you just gave earlier this month in September. So we'll have a link out to that where this interview is located if anyone wants to read that. I would highly encourage anyone in our audience to read that paper, and you also just wrote an op-ed for the Financial Times that was really well done as well, so we'll have links to both of those. But what has been the general reaction to what you've been saying, I would say, within the economic establishment? Because it would seem that there is much more of a consensus building that this is the case, that monetary policy hasn't worked, like you said, and it really hasn't achieved the goals that were originally set out and that were named by Ben Bernanke as QE was being launched. And, you know, there was the means to lower interest rates down to zero. You know, all the beneficial effects that would happen from this, they really haven't been achieved, or not to the extent. And as you're saying, you now believe that at this point, the negative impacts now outweigh the positive. So it seems that there is a building consensus in this direction. Do you see that as well within the economic establishment? Do you think that that is taking place and that people agree, okay, we need to pass the baton? What are your thoughts on that?
I think, in fact, the tide is shifting. I would ask you to recall that the BIS, okay, for whom I used to work, has been making the most important of these points really for 15 years, if not longer, and has been making its arguments directly to the central bankers, who, of course, assemble in Basel at the BIS on a regular basis. And the reaction up until now has just been basically, I think, more an ignoring of the message than an attempt to refute it, that the central banks have basically retreated back into the models that they've got. There's something sort of very human nature about doing that. But we've been on about this for years and years, and nobody's taken any notice. Now, I think people are taking notice. And I think the reason why they're taking notice is that we're so far down the line. You know, think about doubting Thomas, you know, who had to put his finger in the side of Christ. We're so far down the line, and the evidence is accumulating in such a fashion that it's almost impossible at this point to deny the possibility that the BIS line might be right. So that's where I think we're at. I hope that's where we're at. When I got this NABE thing, frankly, I was shocked and amazed because, of course, the conventional line about monetary policy is that it will work and that the side effects can be ignored. And I've actually received a couple of awards here in Europe, mostly from German sources, which in a sense I was pleased and honored with. But I wasn't surprised in the sense that this line is sort of something that the Germans have been pursuing for quite some period of time. Too much, I might add. I can go into that, too. That didn't surprise me. But getting this thing from the NABE people really did surprise me. And I guess I was concerned before I went that, you know, maybe some committee had decided this, and that when I got there, you know, the 300 or 400 people would start throwing buns. But the very opposite was the truth. You know, I said what I said in a, I don't know, 45-minute presentation. And I thought that the mood of the meeting seemed to me to be overwhelmingly positive with respect to what I had to say. So maybe things are beginning to change. I was also at a meeting last week in Rome, an outfit called OMFIF, which is the Official Monetary Institutions and Financial Forum. But it brings together sort of central bankers, sovereign wealth funds, and private sector people. And I must say the mood there, too, was very much one of, yeah, I think this monetary policy thing may have reached the end of its useful life. So I was surprised and pleased at the NABE meeting at the reaction. I'm seeing more and more in the press, too. Now, you know this whole business about cognitive bias. You always see the stuff that you want to see. But it does seem to me that in the course of the last 3 or 4 months, that there's been a real sort of increase in the number of articles in, what's the word, in the serious press about maybe we really have to have another think. The bad side of that is that half of these things have to do with the loss of credibility of central banks, which I'm not pleased about. But it leads then on to the argument that if we can no longer assume that the central banks will get us out of this, then we have to start thinking about what else. So, yeah, I think things are beginning to shift. I'm only sorry it's taken so long, because I think a lot of damage has been done in the interval.
Bill, I want to get to a number of the different items that you suggest we need to do at this point, which is not just fiscal policy, but a wide range of other measures as well. But before we do that, I want to get to a point that you do make in your paper, and that's with regard to something that you've mentioned many times in a lot of your different writings and speeches, and that's this fundamental mistake that you believe is being made by the economic establishment as it relates to the way central policymakers can control the economy. Let's say, what is that mistake that you refer to quite regularly?
The mistake is a philosophical mistake. And this gets us back to sort of a branch of philosophy that used to be known as epistemology. And it really had to do with the question of how do you know, where knowledge is sort of verified true belief. How do you know that your beliefs are true? An epistemologist would say that the economists have made a profound philosophical error. And that error is that we assume that the economy is a kind of machine that is both understandable in terms of its operation and therefore controllable. And I guess my view now for ages and ages, and I think I spoke to you about this in an earlier interview, was that this assumption that the economy is both understandable and controllable is just wrong. That the economy is not understandable and controllable. It's not a machine. It's what the jargon has it. It's a complex adaptive system. And it's a system that is so complicated and so constantly changing that it is just naive to think that you can understand it, much less control it. And I think one of the difficulties in the models that people use, which sort of starts off with this idea about it's understandable and controllable, is that some bits of it are really hard to understand and therefore hard to control. And what the model builders have done, and I mean, I remember doing this myself in the 1970s at the Bank of Canada, is that they've systematically stripped out of the models all of the stuff that's really hard to model. So that all of these models, basically, they've got no money, they've got no credit, they've got no debt, they've got no stocks, they've got no bankruptcies, they have no discontinuities, they have no nonlinearities. I mean, all of these things, in a certain sense, you know, the characteristics of the real world have been taken out of the models in the interests of ensuring that they are understandable and controllable. But that's not science. I mean, to take out the stuff that you don't understand so you can pretend you understand just seems to me as being profoundly non-scientific. And I'm actually reading quite a bit about this stuff at the moment. I mean, I've got books here on my table about, you know, Thomas Kuhn and scientific revolutions and stuff like that. You know, how do the scientists cut into this? And they don't do it by getting rid of all the stuff that's too hard to handle. So that, I think, is the fundamental mistake. It's to misunderstand the nature of the economy. And there's a lot of things that come out of that mistake, too, and not just bad forecasts.
Bill, you mentioned earlier that it seems that perhaps central bankers or economists have now retrenched back into their models. Is that the case that you see playing out today?
There's an element of it. I mean, at a certain point, I think they will have to wake up to reality as the side effects, I guess, become ever more evident and harmful. But Dan Kahneman, you know, in that book of his Thinking Fast and Thinking Slow, if I remember correctly, he talks about what happens when people's belief systems are really shocked. Okay, stuff happens that just couldn't possibly happen. And you would think that the first reaction of people would be to say, that can't happen in my model, so therefore something's wrong with my model. But his contention is that people actually go the opposite way, that they just can't sign on to nothing. They can't sign on to not knowing. And so what they tend to do is retreat back into their old belief system. And in a certain way, and I'm sure I'm oversimplifying here, but it sounds plausible. When you look at our German and American colleagues and what they're doing, what you see is almost precisely that. That in Germany, of course, the most important historical experience that they sort of keep firmly in their mind was the hyperinflation. And so to get out of whatever problems you've got, You've got to get the deficits under control because they'll culminate in hyperinflation. Okay? This is the sort of archetypal German belief. And yet when you look at the United States, it's the very opposite. It's we're on the edge of deflation and the Great Depression, and we've got to fight it tooth and nail. And I think in both cases, they retreated back into their own belief systems. There is now a huge literature about financial crises in 100 countries over 100, if not 200 years. And what those studies now show is there's an incredibly varied set of outcomes from after a financial crisis. And the idea that you can just sort of say, well, it's always going to be like the American experience, or it's always going to be like the German experience, just goes to show that people are not thinking very seriously about what they believe. But I say, I feel a bit sort of embarrassed here because we're sort of in the realm of psychology and people might very easily and rightly say, what does Bill White know about psychology?
We had an interesting interview with Dr. Ben Hunt, and he's the writer of a popular newsletter called Epsilon Theory. And he had an interesting way of viewing the situation that you kind of laid out, which was that a lot of economic models are akin to sort of magical spells. And rather than abandoning the old magic, we just make tweaks to our spells and try to make sure that they affect different results. And that when that doesn't happen, we double down. And so that's kind of where we are today. And it sounds like that's what you're saying as well, is that there's now a doubling down.
I totally agree with them. And in conversations that I have with my colleagues of various places, I would say the big worry is that the central banks have gone so far down this route that really they have no choice from a practical perspective but to double down. And if they do, it'll be a big mistake. I mean, logically, you can't rule out that if they did double what they've done already, that it might just spark aggregate demand and inflationary expectations in an orderly way, and that would be the right solution. I can't logically say that couldn't happen, but I'm very strongly of the view it's not very likely, and that to double down would just simply make things worse.
Now, this goes back to the title of your piece, which is about digging the hole deeper, and that, let's say, central policymakers, they're using monetary policy to dig the hole deeper and deeper, and perhaps we can see that with interest rates going lower and lower. Now, you do lay out in your speech that you gave when you received the Adam Smith Prize, that you think that ultra-easy monetary policy may remain for quite a bit longer than is warranted. Perhaps we're already at that point, and I think that that's really what you're claiming and many others are saying, but it sounds like you think that this delay may happen for even longer. Why is that? What are some of the reasons why you think central bankers may continue in this direction?
There's all sorts of points that could be made that sort of lead you to believe that there's a bias towards more of the same, not least of which is that we've had 7 years of more of the same, after 20 years of more of the same prior to that. So one thing that I think is a source of concern is, as we think about sort of tightening up, is the question of the modalities of doing it. You know, we're starting from a spot here with central bank balance sheets that are so big. We really don't know whether it is possible. I think the Fed says that it's possible. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. The jury's still out on whether you can tighten up with balance sheets that are as big as they are, you know? So then the question becomes, well, let's suppose we can't get interest rates up in the traditional fashion, which is squeezing the reserves because there's too many of them. So why don't we pay interest on the reserves? I mean, this is the other thing. Okay, so this is a way in which you could tighten up, is by paying interest on the reserves. But then the question becomes, well, what's the political sort of ramification of that, where everybody's sort of still suffering, maybe starting to get a bit better, but everybody's still suffering and the central banks are transferring billions of dollars to the banks in the form of interest on excess reserves. So the whole question of the modalities about how do you do it, what might be the side effects of reestablishing control over the interest rates, that's an element of uncertainty. And I think uncertainty sort of is part of the bias towards just don't do anything, just keep doing what you're doing. Another uncertainty, which I think is even bigger, is what happens if they do tighten? And of course, you hear people sort of talking on both sides, right? There's the crowd that says it's going to be 1937 all over again. And there's a crowd that says, no, the real mistake is not tightening. And, you know, you get inflation like in the early 1970s. So there's a lot of uncertainty about what might happen if people do tighten. And I would have to say behind all of that is also a sense that we don't know where potential is. And you see this in the United States with this back and forth about the unemployment rate looks like it's sort of very close to the natural rate, whatever that means. But given the fact that the park rate went down so strongly, is it really sort of, if we keep easy money, will we be able to attract a lot of people back into the labor force? Anyway, my only point is there's a lot of uncertainty about the effects of policy, of tightening policy. Reasonable people can easily differ in their views about this thing. And I think as we've seen in the FOMC, if there's a lot of divergence of view, then the basic message is, well, you don't do anything. And thirdly, there's a lot of people benefiting from the current stance of monetary policy. And they're going to try to exert as much pressure as they can to keep policy the way it is because it supports them. So there'll be a lot of speculators out there who would be sort of, you know, deeply in the lower for longer camp. Government, and I don't want to get into this Trump thing. I think that was really unfortunate, his attacks on the Fed, and totally unwarranted. But there is no doubt that treasuries everywhere are amongst the biggest debtors that there are. And it's the debtors who are sort of gaining from the current policy. So there's going to be a lot of that stuff. And finally, in terms of waiting, I think as I put it in the paper, as hard as it is to believe, central bankers too are human. They're going to worry about what it means for them should they tighten up. And if they tighten up and things go sour, I'm pretty much of the view, and I'm sure they are too, that the great public is not going to say, oh, this was a terribly, terribly complicated situation, and you were just the trigger for what went wrong. They're going to get blamed for it, okay, just like they did during the 1930s. They're going to get blamed for it, and they know they're going to get blamed for it. So all of these things seem to me to, you know, just bias the thing in terms of not tightening as quickly, perhaps, as one might. And when you talk about all of these uncertainties, you've got to be sympathetic to these central bankers. I mean, that is what they are facing. But when you add all of these things up together, I think what you're left with is there's likely to be more bias to being too easy than to start tightening up in an orderly way. Now, having said all of that, I just do want to add in, too, that tightening up in current circumstances, we may be so deeply into all of these sort of bad side effects, the unexpected side effects, etc. Financial markets that don't work properly, financial institutions that have got their rates of return being squeezed. I hear go on and on about all of these things. But the central point is that there may be so many of them at the moment that there isn't a path of tightening that will not lead to some pretty significant problems. Central banks can't continue what they're doing because of all the unexpected side effects, but they can't just raise interest rates or tighten up monetary policy and hope everything will be okay when there's already so many instabilities now built into the system. These complex adaptive systems, one thing we know about them is that they're path dependent, right? You can't go backwards, you can only go forward. But more of the same is not on the cards either. And that's why in the end, in this paper, I come to the conclusion that the central banks have reached the end of their capacities to deal with the current problem. And now arms of government have got to step in to do what needs to be done if there is to be a resolution to the problem.
James Bullard at the St. Louis Fed, he seems to be pretty out in front on the direction of monetary policy in terms of making a significant shift from perhaps being on the hawkish side to more the dovish side. And he's basically explained that when we look at low productivity growth around the world, when we look at a lot of the larger structural forces that are weighing on economic growth, that we really are looking at perhaps a lower for longer outcome. And I believe what he's outlined is kind of a one and done strategy where we hike rates once. At this point, you know, most people think that that may be in December. And then, you know, he's advocated keeping rates low after one hike for about 2 years, all the way through 2018. And then at that point, having to reassess. But recognizing the inability to forecast out that far. So it does seem like we are moving into this lower for longer regime, if you want to call it. And I guess in that case, you know, if we are looking at rates staying relatively low at this level near the zero bound for another year, perhaps two, what are some of the greatest negative impacts? Because you have said, you know, you believe the negative impacts now outweigh the positive. We're moving into that point. What are some areas that you are looking at in particular? Because I do know that you discuss the problem that this is having on pension funds. I think that this is an issue that is receiving much more attention now, insurance companies. So tell us a little bit about some of those negative impacts that you have on your radar.
Well, I guess the first point that I would make is that at a certain point, I think it leads to financial instability. So we think about sort of goosing up the economy as a way to make the whole economy stronger. But I think you can make a reasonable argument that doing it through monetary policy of the sort that they've done actually increases financial instability. And there's a lot of ways in which we're sort of channeled through which you can support that hypothesis. One of the first ones, I guess, is I think what you've already mentioned, which is the contribution of very, very low interest rates and very low spreads to low profits at financial institutions. I mean, I've been doing work with some insurance companies now for a number of years in which they've been sort of consistently recording the fact that they're being nickeled and dimed to death here, and pension funds as well. But interestingly enough, nobody seemed to take any notice at all until quite recently when the banks started complaining about it, particularly in the European and Japanese context, you know, where they've actually gone for negative rates on bank reserves. But the funny thing about it is that these problems of squeezing the term spreads and squeezing the credit spreads and therefore making financial intermediation less profitable, this has been going on for years, and there's nothing different in what's happening at the moment. You know, it's just been going on for ever longer number of years. So that's one problem. And the financial institutions, if they're unsure about their own future solvency, then clearly their willingness to lend is going to be less, which is not good for increasing aggregate demand. Another financial side effect is that financial markets don't seem to be working the way that they did before either. So you think, for example, about, you know, these swings, the ro-ro, as they call it, risk on, risk off. Everybody's looking at the Fed. So the only thing that's important in terms of the financial markets is what the central banks are doing, okay, the Fed in particular. So the correlations between the rates of return on the asset classes have gone way up. And then you start saying to yourself, well, what is that doing for diversification and for value investing? Okay, when the correlations have gone up as much as they have. And then you get the other part of it too, which is it's risk on, risk off. So sometimes the correlations are high because everybody's running away from risk, and other times the correlations are high because everybody's running towards risk. Well, that's basically sort of saying that it's the tail risk thingy that's driving everything. This is not helpful. The whole sort of price discovery mechanism has just disappeared. Closely related to this, of course, is the fact that the levels of many of these financial assets, and actually real assets in some countries as well, have been bid up to levels that really look quite dangerous. You know, so there the worry would be that, you know, even a relatively moderate increase in interest rates might be enough to spark a significant downturn in those prices. And I guess the last thing that I would mention in terms of these undesired consequences on the financial side is that we're starting to see a lot of anomalies in financial markets that seem to me to indicate that the markets are not functioning properly. And the BIS actually has done some great stuff recently. It was in the annual report, but there's also an article in this quarter's quarterly bulletin, the September quarterly bulletin, which looks at the cross-currency basis spread. So, you know, the way they describe it in the article is the closest thing we've got to a physical law in economics is the law of covered interest parity. And it hasn't held since 2009, okay? And it's a combination of central bankers sort of doing what they're doing differently in different currency areas, raising the demand for hedging significantly above what it was prior to 2009. And that's interacting with regulations which basically prevent arbitrage from being carried out as efficiently and costlessly as it used to be. So the combination of these two has basically implied that this physical law of covered interest parity no longer applies. And you can see similar things all over the place. I mean, the cost of CDSs in Europe seems to have nothing to do with the size of the credit differentials. In Japan, it's the same thing between the Nikkei and the TOPEX. The central banks are intruding on these markets in such a way that they really don't function anymore. And we don't know what the side effects will be when times turn tough. So I'm worried about all of that stuff on the financial side. The other thing that I don't think is getting enough attention, and again, the BIS has written quite a bit on this, is I think this easy money, which is designed to increase aggregate demand, is actually decreasing aggregate supply. Okay, so that it's got a downward effect on potential. That may actually be at the heart of why has everything been so slow recently. But certainly worth thinking about. The argument would be that there were a lot of misallocations prior to the crisis. You know, we all know there was far too many resources went into construction, house building, banking, retail, distribution systems, big ships, big resource misallocations. And then since then, sort of the zombie banks and zombie companies have basically prevented the reallocation that should otherwise have occurred. And in addition, as I mentioned before, if the price discovery mechanism is not working in markets and banks and financial institutions are petrified to make loans, there's going to be a lot of misallocations since the crisis as well. So I think there's really valid grounds for believing that there are side effects from these policies and that they're not good side effects. And although this is not a macro thing, and I'll finish with this, I think there are very good grounds for believing that the way policy has been conducted, particularly the increase in asset prices, has benefited rich people at the expense of the middle classes, which is not good given the starting point. And I guess I also believe that what the central banks have done going forward is going to be a significant impediment to their independence from political pressure on setting monetary policy. So there's some political implications from all of this too that I really don't think we should just ignore.
Bill, given your assessment of the situation we face today and a lot of these negative impacts that you outlined that we're seeing currently and will likely to see in the future should we keep down this path, what are some of the scenarios you envision? Because I know that you did discuss a most optimistic and sort of least optimistic outcomes or scenarios that we might see in the future. Would you mind telling our audience a little bit about the range of what you expect?
Well, I think, as always, there are a range of possible outcomes. I mean, I talked about complexity before, complex adaptive systems. The fact of the matter is that they're highly nonlinear and conditional, of course, on what the starting point is. There's lots of possible outcomes. In the paper, I sort of started with, here's a positive outcome, and then I sort of gradually became more pessimistic. The first scenario basically assumes a happy ending, and I think what I say is that somehow growth in the global economy does start to gradually accumulate and get stronger, and that financial markets react in a very orderly way to that reality. So what I mean by that is that the economy is getting slower and the bond rates basically go up, but they go up in a very orderly way, hopefully to a level that's lower than the rate of growth of nominal income, in which case your debt ratios will be going down. So that's a possibility. And I mean, people at the moment talking about increases in business confidence in Europe. Maybe the Chinese thing is not as bad as people said it was before. So you can tell a story. However, in that faster growth scenario, you also have to assume that in spite of that exit bias I referred to before, that the central banks don't fall behind the curve in terms of inflation. Okay? And because if they do, I think the historical evidence is, then they have to start raising rates rather more rapidly than they would otherwise have had to do. And that very frequently, in the post-war period at least, has led to recession. In that situation, you're sort of back again to a place where you don't want to be. Second thing, I mean, this is my happy scenario, but I'm talking about what are some of the risks. One of the risks is that the happy scenario could be interrupted by inflationary pressures. The second risk is that the happy scenario could be interrupted by a disorderly reaction in the bond markets. So that instead of bond markets sort of falling off a bit, they would actually fall off quite a bit. And I think there's a lot of reasons, not least of which is a shortage of collateral and rush to the exits. And there's all sorts of reasons to believe that that's not impossible. Without saying it's very likely, it's certainly not impossible. And if that were to happen, of course, if the interest rates started to go up in this very significant way, I think we would have some problems in the advanced market economies. And I think, too, as things started to unravel, you'd start to get a lot of problems in the emerging market economies as well, that there'd be sort of a flight to the exits there. And, you know, the capital inflows have been pretty big. I think you'd see a reversal of all that. So my bottom line is I can tell a happy story, but I'd have to be realistic and say that there's certain risks to that particular scenario. The other side of it, of course, is that if that's the optimistic scenario, there are sort of darker stories you can tell, which is that growth doesn't pick up for whatever reason, perhaps not least all the side effects of, you know, the policies that have been followed earlier on. Maybe Bob Gordon is right about secular stagnation, but the point of the matter is that if growth doesn't pick up, I think policy rates and bond rates would obviously stay very low. But the difficulty is that we've seen all of these other asset prices, you know, the high risk, the term spreads, the credit spreads, the price of houses in many countries, the price of equity, you know, in the U.S. and in many other places as well. In that slow growth scenario, those currently high prices will start to look unjustified by the fundamentals. And then we see what happens, because you'll get a sort of a reduction, maybe a sharp reduction in the prices of those assets. And then the question becomes, well, who's going to get caught out and what will be the side effects of that happening? So that's, as it were, a more sober sort of dark side of the story. I suspect that in that latter case in particular, we would be more likely to see a doubling down. I think this is sort of what we're seeing in Japan at the moment. And that would be even more worrisome, because the answer to this problem in the low growth scenario is not a futile attempt to stimulate once again using monetary policy. So various stories, but it's hard to be an unconditional optimist, because even the optimistic story, there's risks associated with it.
So, Bill, the less optimistic scenario would be central bankers or monetary policy being used to dig a deeper and deeper hole, I would take it, and that would lead to dangerous bubbles in various assets, whether or not we're looking at bonds, real estate, stocks. And, you know, some would say that we're actually already there. But putting that aside, let's talk about some of the steps that you do outline in your speech that you think represent a better way forward than what we have seen already.
Let me start off by saying that where we are is not where we want to be. And that the suggestions that I would make, I recognize perfectly clearly that there are downsides to all of the things that I'm putting on the table. But the problem is, as far as I can tell, I hope I'm wrong, but I don't think I am. The problem is that given where we are, there are no other options on the table other than the ones that I'm suggesting. And the way that I've described it in sort of various documents is that we need a series of policies on both the demand side and the supply side of the economy. And I characterized it in the FT article you referred to as, we must please both Keynes and Hayek. We must worry about both demand side elements and supply side elements. Now, what do I mean? On the demand side, I think something that sort of more and more people are talking about is countries with room for maneuver should use it in the interest of short-run fiscal stimulus. The problem is, after all these years, is that there are not so many countries that are in that situation. And there are some that might look like they're in that situation, but would be worried that the markets would attack them anyway. Okay? Whatever that means, those who feel they have fiscal room for maneuver should use it. I think that the room for maneuver could actually be increased by credible legislation to ensure that the medium-term framework will lead to sustainable debt levels. And it is possible to bring in such legislation. Many countries have done it, debt breaks, all this kind of thing. But, of course, future legislatures are never bound by past legislatures, so there's a flaw. Closely related on this fiscal action side. I think there's a lot of countries where people should be looking much more closely at relative factor incomes than they have been. The proportion of total factor incomes going to labor has been going down and down in many, many countries. Profit levels have been going up and up. And I think Raghu Rajan pointed this out many years ago, I think around 2005, that if the poor people, the workers, are getting squeezed and they've got no money to spend, then either they don't spend it or they borrow the money and spend it, and that's only a sort of short-run thing. And it also creates more problems going ahead. So the real issue here is going back and rethinking this business about wages, whether in fact, you know, minimum wages, things of that nature ought not to be given more attention than they have been. So this is all sort of demand-side stuff. On the supply-side stuff, you know, this would please Hayek, if we have problems with too much debt, and the debt is sort of interfering not just with demand, but the willingness of people to lend, we have a kind of insolvency problem as opposed to an illiquidity problem. And debt levels globally actually are 20% of GDP higher now, or at least at the end of 2015, than they were in 2007. So we haven't gone through a period of deleveraging. There's been a bit of it in the States, but globally, the whole thing has gone in the opposite direction, I think, under the influence of these ultra-easy monetary policies. So I think, again, this is on the supply side thing. I think we need to address the question of debt sustainability, debt restructuring, bankruptcies, and associated legislation much more carefully than we've done up until now. And lastly, on the supply side, is this business about supply side reforms, all the kind of stuff that the OECD is constantly going on about, you know, labor market reforms, product market reforms, you name it. But there's all of that stuff that's, you know, easing entry into business, easing exit out of business, back to bankruptcy laws. The OECD has got a wide, wide range of these structural policies that could usefully be followed. So I think we need all of these things. And I think in the measure that people would say, but, well, maybe more fiscal, you know, higher wages, whatever, it'll lead to inflation, then I would say proceed with these other things and offset the inflation with tighter monetary policy. Because keeping it where it is with all the unintended consequences is, again, not where you want to be. So those would be my suggestions. And as I say, I'm not naive. All of these things will be politically difficult to do. And in fact, I think you can make a reasonable case that the basic reason why the governments have done what they've done, i.e. rely on monetary policy alone, is because doing the other things is politically more difficult. And they just, in some cases, desperately want to believe that the central bankers have got it under control. But they haven't. That's the reality. And so the things that government should have done a number of years ago, I think about the G20 initiative, I think it was in 2010, just before the Greek thing broke. The things that government should have done a number of years ago, it's not too late to do them now. It's later, and certainly later than I would like, but it's not too late to start thinking about doing them now, because I think monetary policy has done what it can.
We've been speaking with William White once again. He is the chairman of the Economic and Development Review Committee at the OECD, and he's also the former chief economist at the Bank for International Settlements. William, we are going to have a link out to our listeners to both of your pieces, Ultra Easy Money, Digging the Hole Deeper, which was your Adam Smith Prize lecture, as well as your recent Financial Times article, which was just released on their site as well. If our listeners wanted to follow more of your work, what would be the best way to do so?
Well, I've got a website, and I sort of put everything up there. It's www.williamwhite.ca, and the CA stands for Canada.
Bill, thank you for coming on to FS Insider and speaking with our audience about your views, and it's always a pleasure to hear where you think things should go and the difficulties that we face today and the scenarios that we may see unfold in the years ahead. We always appreciate speaking to you on our program, and all the best to you in Paris where you are currently.
Well, it's always a pleasure to talk to you, Chris. Thank you very much for all of these really stimulating questions.
So according to William White, the basic message is that monetary policy was used to stimulate aggregate demand, and yet it has failed. And not only that, but there's now a large number of negative side effects that he thinks are building and that are going to become more and more of a risk as we go forward. He laid out some of those, saying that we could be looking at further financial instability. Of course, bubbles are one risk. And then at that point, when you do move into a bubble, whether or not we're looking at bonds, real estate, stocks, or you have it, the chance for a bubble bursting and the impacts that that'll have on people who have been caught wrong-footed or even those in the real economy. Let's say, for example, someone buying a home in Toronto or Vancouver or Australia, areas like that where clearly we're reaching bubble-like levels, the impacts that that'll have upon just your average household, that is a risk. He also laid out the fact that public pension funds are now greatly underfunded and that persisting at very low rates is only making those problems worse. And of course, there was a number of other things that he also outlined as well in terms of breaking financial markets and the lack of price discovery. The interesting thing is that he really laid all this out extremely well in his ultra easy money, digging the hole deeper speech, which he just gave earlier this month in reception of the Adam Smith Prize. And I think that that does reflect that we really are moving in that direction. At least there's much more of a consensus now building that, hey, monetary policy has lost its effectiveness. Not only that, but the negative impacts are now outweighing the positive. And so given where we at and the global situation that we face today, when it comes to the Hayek side of the argument, the supply side reform, when we consider the need for debt restructuring, bankruptcies, and really trying to reduce debt levels, you know, one of the things that he had said when we spoke to him earlier this year is that the situation today is worse than it was in 2007. And the basis for saying that is when you look at the fact that debt levels have climbed much higher than what we saw before the last financial crisis. And so now we have debt levels both in the advanced economies and the emerging economies very high, particularly when we look at China. The Bank for International Settlements and other banks and economists have been pointing out that when we look at debt loads in China, they are off the charts, perhaps nothing that we've ever seen before in history. And so that is probably exhibit A when we think of this massive need for debt restructuring and increase bankruptcies, and it done in an orderly fashion, if that is possible. Again, if you'd like to read any more about William White's thinking on many of these topics, whether it is China, whether it is the risk to financial markets, the various scenarios that he thinks we could see unfold going forward, I would encourage you to go to his website, williamwhite.ca. We'll have a link to his site where this interview is located, along with the two papers that we discussed today.
All right. Thank you. Appreciate it, Chris. And Jim, next week, we will be back on more of a normal schedule for the Financial Sense News Hour. What are financial things over the hill that we're watching?
Well, we're still watching some of these economic reports. We got that surprise print on third quarter GDP. We'll see if that carries over into the fourth quarter. Typically, over the last 7 years, we have not seen that. Fourth quarter tends to weaken. Also going into the first quarter, we've got earnings announcements. Some of the companies disappointing, which is offsetting some of that good news on the economy this Friday. And then, of course, John, the big event. We're less than 2 weeks away from silly season finally being over, and we'll know who the next president of the United States will be, Donald Trump or Secretary Hillary Clinton. And, of course, there will be all kinds of bets being made once that decision is made by the American public in terms of what will the markets be doing, trying to position themselves in terms of type of stocks that would do better in a Clinton presidency versus a Trump presidency. So we'll have lots to talk about as we head into the final finish of the year. In the meantime, on behalf of John Leffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense News Hour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.